I am here with professor, evolutionary psychologist, writer, as well as the owner of a popular YouTube channel known as The Sad Truth, Gad Sad. How are you doing, sir?
How are you? Nice to meet you.
Nice to finally meet you. I've seen a bunch of your work, especially on Joe Rogan. You've been on Joe Rogan like 5 times, if I'm not mistaken.
I think maybe 6, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Okay, well, you have a new book coming out called The Parasitic Mind. Do you want to give a maybe 3-minute summation of that before we move into more specific questions?
Absolutely. So many animals can be infested, if you like, or infected with parasites in various parts of their body. So even humans can have a tapeworm that goes into their intestine. Well, neuroparasitology is the area of study that looks at what happens when these parasites go to an organism's brain, causing the organism, the host, to behave in all sorts of irrational ways. So for example, a mouse can be infected with a parasite known as Toxoplasma gondii. And when it is infected with this parasite, it loses its innate fear of cats and it becomes sexually attracted to the cat's urine. That's not a very good outcome for a mouse. Another type of parasite is something that afflicts ungulates, deer, moose, elk, something that you have in the wildlife in Sweden. Well, when a moose is infected with this parasite, it will often start engaging in circling behavior. It just goes around in a circle, never able to extricate itself from this motion. So even if the wolves are coming in on it, it can't flee because the parasite is making it go in this motion. So I take this idea of neuroparasitology and I argue that humans can be parasitized by another class of parasites. I call these idea pathogens, really bad ideas that can cause us to go to the proverbial cat when we are mice, that can cause us to go into the abyss of infinite lunacy. And like any good epidemiologist, I look for the origins of this infestation. Where did it come from? And regrettably, as a professor, I'm here to tell you that all of these idiotic ideas come from the university setting. It takes intellectuals to come up with really stupid ideas. And so then what I do in the book is I describe these idea pathogens, and then I offer a vaccination against these idea pathogens. So in the same way that we are now looking for a vaccination, for an inoculation against COVID-19, well, I argue that there is a way for us to have good mental hygiene so that we are not parasitized by these bad ideas. So that's, in 3 minutes or less, a summary of the book.
That's interesting what you said, that it takes intellectuals to come up with really bad ideas. It is a phenomenon called over-education, being over-educated. Are you familiar with that?
Sure.
That is interesting to me. How come being smarter makes you dumber?
Well, I think what happens in the cases of the idea pathogens that I discuss in the book, and if you want, we can talk about some specific idea pathogens. I think it starts off from a noble cause. And so they become, if you like, married to these bad ideas because they are pursuing some higher ideal. So let me give you an example. Cultural relativism is an idea that basically says, hey, who are we to judge the values of other cultures? There are no absolute truths. There are no absolute moral guidelines. Whatever some culture does in their exotic lands, it's for them to decide. Well, that originally came from the notion that we didn't want to create hierarchies of cultures. We don't want to say these folks are superior to those folks. And therefore, we created a narrative that frankly is removed from reality, right? There are some cultural values that are dreadful. Cutting off the clitorises of little girls, there is no worldview where that is a good idea. Or take, for example, the rejection of biology, the fact that people are perfectly willing to accept that biology is relevant for all other species except humans. When it comes to humans, somehow we transcend our biology. We're cultural animals. Well, the ones who came up with this idea originally were cultural anthropologists who thought that in the wrong hands, biology will result to very bad outcomes. The Nazis used Darwinian explanations. I say in quotes because it had nothing to do with Darwin. Look, there's a struggle between the races. It's a Darwinian struggle. We are the Aryans. So if we kill off the Jews, hey, who cares? That's just Darwinian, right? So because all sorts of really nasty folks misused evolutionary theory, then these lofty intellectuals came up with a whole new set of fields whereby biology no longer matters for human behavior. But that's a very silly idea because physics, we don't reject physics because people can build atomic bombs, right? We don't simply say no more physics for you. So all of these bad ideas, all of them share a common original goal of trying to create a better world. But in the pursuit of creating a better world, we shouldn't murder truth. We can both have a better world and adhere to the truth.
That's interesting, because it really does seem to be a matter of ego, in a sense, that someone thinks of them as a savior, a hero. They have good intentions, but it's interesting how being overeducated leaves you... It's not the same thing as real life experience, and it's not the same thing as being grounded in reality. It makes you too theoretical for your own good. And on the topic of universities, have you noticed this firsthand? You're a university professor, right? So have you noticed how ideologically poisoned things are there?
Well, of course. I've been warning against this stuff for more than two decades. I was, if I may say, probably the first and most consistent lone wolf crying out against what we now see has spread across every single fabric of our culture, right? So take, for example, the idea of equality of outcomes versus equality of opportunities, right? Well, equality of outcomes is a dreadful idea. It's a cancer against individual dignity, right? There is no reason to assume that just because X percentage of the population may sub that population, that there should be X number of people who are neurosurgeons or mathematicians or models, right? Equality of opportunities is something that we should, you know, seek to achieve, right? Well, that idea of equality of outcomes became formalized as what I call the DAI religion, diversity, inclusion, and equity. So now we no longer in academia give professorships based on the merit of your dossier, right? It doesn't matter if you have a Nobel Prize and you have an incredible lab and you're doing great science. What matters is that you either belong to a particular group or not. It's grotesque. It's an affront to what made our societies great. So I've been seeing this in academia for, you know, more than two decades. But I should just mention one thing. Earlier you mentioned, you know, being detached from reality. The extent to which these idea pathogens parasitize different fields is a function of whether those bad ideas have consequences or not. So for example, when you are in the humanities or in some of the social sciences, you can propose all kinds of, forgive the term, bullshit, because you are removed from the consequences of your stupidity. Whereas you can't be a postmodernist and build bridges, because there is a thing called physics that will make the bridge collapse. You can't build aerodynamic planes using postmodernist theory, because the plane will crash. So in the business school where I am housed, or in, for example, engineering, you are less likely to see some of these idiotic ideas spread, because we are tied to reality. There is a metric by which the value of our ideas is judged. Although, even in the business school and in engineering, we're starting to see this stupidity spread.
What you're talking about has been noticeable probably in every Western country, in all their schools and universities. It's highly noticeable here in Sweden. I think it was an alarming percent of people who weren't even aware of the Gulag's existence and the consequences of communism, you know, the ideology of equality. So, but if you were to believe Soviet defector Yuri Bezmenov, he warned about a lot of this stuff. Are you familiar with his testimony?
Yeah, so I've had a million people send me the famous clip, which I am ashamed to say I've yet to watch, but apparently it is incredibly valuable to watch it. So maybe you've convinced me that I should go ahead and watch it after this chat.
You should, because it really, he basically describes it as a communist propaganda destabilization method, where they pump their own ideology into the young, impressionable minds of the schools and the universities. And when you look at all the stuff that's being taught there, the critical theory, the intersectionality, the radical feminism and socialism, that kind of stuff divides a country more than, you know, the opposite, than biology, individualism, and you know, rational thought. So it really is something that's benefiting Russia and China to have the young people, the young generation of a country, be eager to tear their own society apart. It's a very interesting clip. You should totally watch it.
I will, absolutely. I refer to some of these idea pathogens as intellectual terrorism. And the analogy that I like to use is, on 9/11, 19 zealots who were very committed to their ideology decided to fly planes onto buildings. Well, postmodernists fly planes of bullshit into our edifices of reason. So they are doing the exact same thing, but using different means. Instead of physical terror, it's intellectual terror, right? Because it is completely nihilistic, right? Postmodernism basically says that there are no absolute truths. Everything is subjective. Well, when a scientist wakes up in the morning, he or she thinks that there is a truth to be discovered. Otherwise, there's no point in getting out of bed. Now, truth can change. What scientists might have thought was true 300 years ago gets updated. So truth is always provisional, but we do start the day with the presumption that there are truths to be discovered. So imagine how much of a dead end it is to teach generations of students that everything is subjective, there are no truths, it's only my truth that matters rather than some capital truth. That's why I refer to postmodernism as the granddaddy of all idea pathogens. By the way, each of these idea pathogens, militant feminism, cultural relativism, identity politics, intersectionality, postmodernism, rejection of biology, they all share one thing in common. They wish to free us from the shackles of reality, right? Trans activism frees me from the shackles of my genitalia. Militant atheism frees, not atheism, forgive me. Militant feminism frees me from the shackles of biology, right? Social constructivism basically says we are all born with equal potentiality, with nothing in our brains, empty, empty slate, and it's only socialization that then shapes our trajectory in life. Well, that's a very hopeful message because Angry Foreigner would love to know that his son is very likely to become the next Lionel Messi. That's a nice message, but guess what? It's a bullshit message. My child and yours probably doesn't have as equal of a chance to have become Lionel Messi as Lionel Messi. There is a unique constellation of genes that make up Lionel Messi that was more likely to make him Lionel Messi. I was never likely to become an NBA superstar the way Michael Jordan was because I'm shorter than him, because I don't have his vertical leap. But my God, would it be nice to teach all parents that any of your children could be anything? It's hopeful, it's lovely, and it's bullshit.
Very well put there. To what degree do you think that biology and genetics dictates political attitudes? You talk about idea pathogens, but can you say the same for like general orientations?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I have a section in The Parasitic Mind where I talk about male social justice warriors who are exhibiting a type of political orientation. So I ref the subject heading of that section is male social justice warriors as sneaky fuckers. Now, I know it sounds like I'm using a derogatory, profane term, but that actually is a zoological term that began in the 1970s. Sneaky fucker strategy, the fancy, more scientific term, is called kleptogamy or sexual mimicry. This is where you have in some species, typically it's the males who do this, right? They engage in female sexual mimicry. So there are, for example, two types of phenotypes of males. There's the dominant, physically imposing male, and then there are other males who, just because of the genetic accidents, don't look very masculine for that species. So then what they will take up as a strategy is they will mimic being females so that then the males will allow them to enter and then they could surreptitiously mate with the females. And so that became known as sneaky fucker strategy. Well, I've argued for many years now that male social justice warriors are engaging in a form of sneaky fucker strategy because usually the male social justice warrior doesn't look like the Navy SEALs that went and killed bin Laden. And as a matter of fact, I have one of my current graduate students who is testing these ideas with me for his thesis, except that because of COVID now, we can't collect some of the data. Now, I'm going to come to your general question in a roundabout way. So there is a lot of research that shows that, for example, physical formidability, how strong a male is linked to his political orientation and economic belief system. So, for example, egalitarianism, we should distribute our resources so that we are all equal, taken to the extreme communism, is something that men who are physically formidable don't support. So there is actually some phenomenal scientific research that links political orientation and, you know, my views on how economic systems should be run to specific types of biological metrics, including whether I am strong or not. So there you go.
That's very interesting, because I think we've all noticed the pattern of creepy feminist males. And I think, and also, you know, whenever you check out Antifa riots, it's not really the bulky guys that, it's usually like a scrawny rich kid that gets involved.
Scrawny rich kid. And by the way, the red and blue hair, I even have an evolutionary explanation for that. So this, if I may offer it here.
Please, please do. That's fascinating.
So in nature, there's something called, I discussed this actually in my first book. In 2007, I published The Evolutionary Basis of Consumption, which is how do you apply evolutionary psychology to study consumer behavior. And in the book, I talk about what's called aposomatic coloring. So for example, if you look at certain frogs in the Amazon, they are incredibly bright colored, right? They, in other words, you would think that in the dangerous neighborhood that they live in, with predators looming everywhere, the last thing you would want evolution to select is for you to be conspicuous, right? You want to be camouflaged. Well, they're not camouflaged. They have bright, bright yellow. I mean, just if you later do a Google image search, you'll see these unbelievably gorgeous, you know, frogs that you could see from space. They are so conspicuous. So how could they have evolved such conspicuous colors if they should be trying to hide from predators? Well, that's called aposomatic coloring. What that's basically saying is, hey, if you could see me, that's probably because you don't want to mess with me, because I am likely to be very poisonous. So stay away at your peril. Well, of course, what ends up by happening, by the way, other species will engage in mimicry, right? Life is very, very deceptive. So you will have another species that's completely harmless, that's not in the least bit poisonous, but that will also evolve aposomatic coloring, even though the predator can't tell them apart. Well, what a lot of these super fierce, venomous, and poisonous social justice warriors are doing is they're basically saying, look at my red hair and my blue hair. You don't want to mess with me. I am ideologically fierce. There's your explanation.
Yeah, no, you can tell the pink-haired feminist stereotype usually comes with a bitchy attitude and tons of penis envy. So I'd say your explanation there is very interesting.
Well, thank you.
It's interesting too how men that can't compete through traditional means, I seem to recall Jordan Peterson talked about this too on the Joe Rogan podcast, they tend to compete through feminine means instead. It's like they can't compete by being typical males, so they'll just, like you said, use feminine tactics instead, like pretending to be an ally and stuff like that.
Well, and by the way, that speaks, sorry to interrupt you, that speaks to the idea in evolutionary psychology that there might be a common Darwinian goal that we are all pursuing, but the ways by which we try to pursue it might vary across individuals. So seeking social status so that we can get access to women is the ultimate goal, but then I might seek it through becoming a famous soccer player or a diplomat or a neurosurgeon or a Joe Rogan with $110 million Spotify deal. So there are many ways by which each male can instantiate the same strategy of must seek status to get the ladies, which by the way speaks to a really important point, which is a lot of idiots who don't like evolutionary thinking in explaining human behavior, they argue wrongly that, oh, that's because it's biologically deterministic. It's basically saying, oh, you know, we are, you know, robots to our genes, and they don't like this idea. Well, we're not robots to our genes, because as I just explained to you, everything is an interplay, an interaction between the environment and our genes. If I am a great athlete, then maybe I will instantiate seek status through being a great soccer player. If I am super smart, I will become a dot-com entrepreneur and make billions of dollars. So there isn't a singular strategy that we all must pursue to instantiate that goal.
It seems like the creepy male feminist strategy doesn't work most of the time, though, because those guys end up being pretty, unsuccessful. I wonder if there's if this is a evolutionary error, or what do you think is the solution to dealing with these creepy new tactics?
According to whom? How women should react to them? How alpha males should react to them? Who should react to them?
I mean, what does it take to make men stop being simps?
Oh, I see. Well, I would say that, look, there's something in mate choice. So let me step back. There's something called compensatory decision rule or non-compensatory decision rule. A compensatory decision rule would be women choose men along many different attributes, and they pick the top package so that even if I don't do well on one attribute, I can compensate for it by being well, doing well on another. So I may be shorter. Typically, women love taller guys. If I don't happen to be tall, that doesn't mean that I'm going to be a celibate monk, because maybe if I become a ultra successful, charismatic, charming, high status, rich guy, I could make up for the lack of inches in my height. Therefore, one compensates for the other. A non-compensatory rule would be, no, if you're not 6 feet tall, I don't date you. Meaning that even if you had everything else that was perfect, if you're not 6 feet tall, you're out, right? Well, the good news for all the viewers listening to this is that for most mate choices, it is a compensatory process. So even though I may not have the perfect Navy SEAL brawn morphology, I may make up for that by doing well on other metrics. So we're not doomed to a life of celibacy. Now, if you are whiny and you have a pear-shaped body and you go to those rallies and you're unemployed and you have a nasal voice and you're not assertive, well, then you are failing on all of the attributes. So nothing compensates for the other. But the fact that you are not a classical jock doesn't mean that you won't necessarily be very successful with the ladies. Think about Pablo Picasso. Pablo Picasso was a short little ugly guy. He was bald. He didn't have the six pack, but he had an extremely long lineup of incredibly beautiful women who wanted to sleep with him because he was Pablo Picasso. So if you are a beta male watching this clip, get your ass off the couch and go do something productive, and the ladies will come.
That is a very sound message. I hope more men listen to that. Speaking about your book, there's a chapter there called Ostrich Parasitic Syndrome. Now, what is that, and how does it relate to countries like Sweden?
Well, I often joke that Sweden is patient zero of OPS, ostrich parasitic syndrome, because it seems as though you guys were at the, you know, at well, at literally at patient zero of some of the dumbest ideas. By the way, the social engineering of removing gender and so on, started in Sweden before it came anywhere else, right? So ostrich parasitic syndrome is the malady whereby, irrespective of the amount of evidence that one can provide you ignore that data because you prefer to construct your own version of reality. The reason why I call it ostrich, even though ostriches don't actually do this, is because there's the metaphor of the ostrich that burrows its head in the sand so that, la la la, I don't want to hear what you have to say. Now, I call it ostrich parasitic syndrome, parasitic because of the ideas in the book of how these idea parasites can ruin our ability to think. Well, when it comes to Sweden, for example, but now more generally the West, if you look at its relationship with Islam, the West, being the infinitely tolerant cultures that we argued that it is absolutely grotesque and Nazi-like to ever criticize Islam because, bruh, that's racist, right? Therefore, it didn't matter how much evidence one might be able to offer you that suggests, look, you might want to be a bit more picky in terms of choosing people who share your values. Irrespective, look, there could be a Muslim guy who is very committed to liberal, enlightened ideas that I prefer to have in my country more than an Orthodox Jew. So it's not a question of whether he is Muslim or Christian or atheist. It's a question of whether the people who we let in share our cultural compass. If they do, welcome in, my brother. If many of your values are perfectly antithetical to our cultural values, well, then we might have a problem having you assimilate in our societies. Well, the West said no. Anybody who says something as trivially obvious as what I just said is basically akin to Hitler. I can't tell that you're not Hitler, right? So that's an example of ostrich parasitic syndrome, because basically what ends up happening, as I explained in the chapter that you mentioned, you come up with all sorts of strategies to negate reality. So if a bunch of terrorists put out a public video before they go out and bomb somewhere and they say, we are doing this because of our religion, here are the seven passages in our religion why we're doing it, then some super bright professor from Oberlin College comes out and says, no, they didn't do it because of their religion. It's because they weren't sufficiently exposed to art. Had they been exposed to art more, then the Brussels guys would not have done it. In my book, I list all of the reasons that I found that super smart professors have come up with for reasons why Ahmed Muhammad Mujahideen has done something. It's never due to Islam, but it's due to lack of solar panels. It's due to beard bullying. It's due to lack of art exposure. And these are not even Gadsad satire. These are things that I can take you to the place where they made those arguments. That's what ostrich parasitic syndrome is. I could love individual Muslims like my brothers, but I can also say that if I have 36,000 terror acts since 9/11 alone in 70 plus countries, that maybe there is a link between the ideology and terror. And I can perfectly say that while loving all Muslims.
Yes, there's an important distinction there between the religion and the followers. The followers, people tend to be more mixed and morphic than religious scripture. Now, you have a background as a Jew from Lebanon, is that correct?
That is very correct. We left in 1975. In a sense, you and I have similar histories in that you left a war-torn area. In your case, you were of the Muslim faith. That's correct, right?
I have a Muslim background, and Bosnia was attacked by Serbia.
Okay, exactly. So we left we were part of the last wave of Jews that had remained, doggedly in Lebanon, because Lebanon was our homeland. We were completely Arabic in our culture. My mother tongue is Arabic. We've been in the land for thousands of years. As the 20th century progressed, it became more and more difficult and dangerous and precarious to be Jewish in Arab lands. And so there would be these exoduses of Jews from Morocco, from Syria, from or either expelled or exterminated or combination of. In Lebanon, there was still a small, very small Jewish community in the 70s. We were part of that last community. And then when the Civil War broke out in the mid-70s, so I was there the first year of the Civil War, then it became, impossible to be Jewish in Lebanon. And so we had to leave Lebanon. My parents, after we emigrated to Canada, my parents then kept going back to Lebanon, back and forth, because they still had some businesses there. And in 1980, they were kidnapped by Fatah, and they disappeared for a while, and we thought that they had been executed. Through a miracle, we were able to free. I say we. I had nothing to do with it. I was a young teenager, but the surrounding, their friends and my older siblings and so on, were able to free them. And so since 1980, nobody in my family has returned to Lebanon. But of course, the reason why that story, my personal history, is relevant, because I have lived the most severe consequences of identity politics, right? So what we are now seeing in the West, what you are seeing in Sweden, what you have been so wonderfully documenting in the reality of Sweden, is something that we will increasingly see throughout the West, because rather than rejecting identity politics, we are creating the perfect ecosystem for having a repeat of Beirut, Lebanon all over the West.
It's already happening here. Sweden has gotten headlines about them quite a few times because Jews are running away from Malmö. They think Israel is safer than Sweden now. So, and I sent you the link to the recent Quran burning protests. That whole event just showed how Swedish people really have no idea on the massive distinction between their culture and cultures they're importing. So it's definitely something that's relevant for all Western countries.
Is your moniker of angry foreigner, does the anger come from the fact that you're angry at their inability to heed the warnings? Is that the idea of the term?
Yeah, I'm stuck in a country that's insane. Ostrich parasitic syndrome is a pretty good description of what's going on here because they do stick their. Well, the thing is, they stick their head in the sand, but they still keep yelling racist at you from their head in the sand. So it's pretty much the same thing that goes on.
Have you been able to, in your own public engagement, to see some of the folks who were most terminally ill with OPS be exposed to your contributions and then come around and say, now I see it, now I'm on board, now I get it? Or is it a fatal disease and there's no way out of it?
That's a very interesting question because I do. It is one of the things that motivates me to keep going. I do get fan mail every once in a while, and it's usually a similar pattern. It's people saying, the first time I saw you, I thought you were a filthy racist, yada, yada, yada. I didn't like anything you said. Now I realize you had a point, or now I agree with you on nearly everything. That's happened quite a few times, yes. And I think what it is good debating requires patience. You have to point reality out to people. And then you're just planting the seed, and it has to unfold at their own pace through their own experience. So I've noticed that people tend to change their mind when they're actually exposed to it, when they actually experience it, which is interesting because it ties around to what we were talking about professors earlier, how academia is a safe environment to never have to actually exercise your bullshit ideas. I noticed that with the large portion of the population here, the typical Swede. White flight is a pretty broadly happening syndrome here. So Swedes and immigrants don't really live with each other. But I've noticed that when a ethnically homogenous municipality, city, neighborhood, whatever, takes in a bunch of refugees, well, all of a sudden they become more willing to vote for the Sweden Democrats because they were only talking about their ideas, not actually living them.
Right. Now, I also know that in Sweden, this is something I don't specifically refer to it in the Swedish case, but Sweden are certainly very good at it. Engaging in self-flagellation, right? Yeah, you understand what self-flagellation? That so, if the immigrants are not assimilating well, it certainly can't be because they have values that are antithetical to these enlightened secular societies. It's because us evil white Swedes have simply not been generous enough, kind enough, tolerant enough. And I actually noticed it because I had been invited to speak, this is probably, I think, 2013 in Norway. When I got to the airport, the gentleman who picked me up, I mean, basically the airport was Somalia, right? There was no way for me to know that I had just landed in Oslo, not in Somalia. So I very gently wanted to probe what he thought of this, right? But of course, he's very politically correct. He doesn't, right? So he starts with the whole, it's our fault, we're evil, right? And so on. I'm guessing that that really describes Sweden to the T, no?
I've seen that so many times. I like it. It gets that's what gets the big media megaphone. That reasoning, the idea that structural injustices, structural racism, blah blah blah. Like it really is very frequent, very very happening. What you're talking about there.
Why is it that, I don't mean to be asking you questions, but I figured it's just a conversation, so I hope you don't mind that I'm
Of course,
asking
of
you.
course.
What do you think made you? So you are born into that environment, yet something about you made you say, no, I'm not going to be parasitized by that ideology, right? What do you think is it about you? Is it that you had parents who supported your leaving the faith? Is it that it's the unique combination of your genes that doesn't allow you to tolerate bullshit? What is it like? How can we clone angry foreigner to get other people to be free of OPS?
Well, it's not really my parents are Muslim, so they weren't really necessarily supportive, but they're not gonna kick me out of the family either. So it's not really, I'd say it's the autism. Yeah. Totally the autism, 100%. I have Asperger syndrome. I think I might have ADD too. So that in itself creates a very immune, easily annoyed with irrationality kind of person, Right.
Well, that's an interesting because I wonder if there's a hypothesis there to test scientifically. I mean, so generally what you're then saying is then someone who is autistic is less likely to succumb to the shackles of political correctness, if only because they don't modulate their behavior. I don't care what you think of me because I'm not even reading the cues on your face because I'm stuck in my autistic world. So is that effectively what you're saying? Did I summarize what you're saying correctly?
Kind of. The thing is, I've seen a ton of SJWs who do have various mental syndromes, mental disorders, but I say that's a higher chance. Yeah, there's a higher chance in that you're rationally minded and interested in data and facts, and you're very sensitive to bullshit, anything that annoys you. So in a sense, but then there's also the cultural aspect that I do come from a culture. I mean, Bosnia has a very straightforward in terms of dialogue and speaking philosophy. We don't sugarcoat anything. A lot of our proverbs are vulgar. It's a very straightforward, masculine culture. So I think when you have the genetics and the cultural background there, you kind of, I would say those are the contributing factors.
Sorry, did you finish?
Yes.
So because you're talking about a particular, mental condition with political correctness and so on, there is a great story that I recount in one of my academic papers. The story comes from Oliver Sacks, who is a famous neurologist who wrote many. He's passed away now, but he wrote many books, great books about, his clinical practice. So a neurologist is someone who studies, various types of, mental disorders. Let's say you suffered a stroke and you've lost your ability to recognize faces, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you literally can no longer tell whether your wife is your wife and so on. And so in one of the cases that he describes, it's absolutely brilliant. So he was doing his rounds in the hospital and he walks by a room where in that particular room, all the people that were there suffered from aphasia. They no longer had the ability to understand spoken word, okay, for various reasons. Okay, they might have had a tumor, they might have a stroke, but whatever reason, they have aphasia. So they were looking at the television, and I think the president at the time might have been Ronald Reagan, and they're listening to the speech, and they're all cracking up laughing. So he kind of looks, he's puzzled because they, by definition, they don't have the ability to understand what he's saying, yet they are all transfixed on the screen and they're laughing. And it turns out what they were laughing at was the fact that because they no longer were obscured by the fact that they have to listen to the words, they could only hear the intonations. And the intonations sounded very fake to them, as though it is somebody who's making jokes and so on. So in other words, so that speaks to how politicians, most of them, including someone who is revered as Ronald Reagan, are basically just spewing bullshit. So that when you take someone who has a mental condition like aphasia, they might actually be better at detecting the gist of that message than you and I who understand the spoken word. So I'm kind of linking that to your autism, whereby because you have that condition, it actually allows you to have a more crystal clear view of some of these issues.
Yes, absolutely. I've noticed that myself, and I was gonna write about it a lot in an autobiography I'm working on. How the very way your brain works makes you kind of. It's like I can understand what politicians are saying when they use fancy words, but I can also read between the lines and understand that this is horseshit. Your body language does not impress me. I'm only paying attention to what's going on with patterns and logic and hard data. So I definitely think it kind of works as a vaccine. I mean, political correctness is definitely oppressive towards people who have various disorders, because A, dark humor is a way of dealing with unpleasant things in life, social exclusion. I think the movie Joker does a really good extreme parallel to that. Like the people who are good with dark humor usually have some kind of suffering in their baggage. So that's a necessity that PC culture will just label racist. But also, some people don't really know when they're being inappropriate, and they also have a strong genetic preference for speaking a certain way. So it's going to be very hard for them to be politically correct because they're not really I mean, they're not really interested or able to.
Well, speaking of dark humor, I mean, one of the strategies that I use, so I use different persuasion strategies in different forums, right? If I'm giving a lecture at Stanford University on my scientific work, I'm obviously going to use a different set of, communication strategies than if I'm communicating with someone on social media, right? This doesn't mean that I've changed persona. Doesn't mean that I'm. It means that an intelligent person is able to have many tools in his or her toolbox for different purposes, right? I don't use a window washer to hammer a nail. That's why I have different tools in my toolbox. Well, one of the very frequent tools that I use that speaks to this dark humor is I use satire and sarcasm as part of my arsenal of weaponry, because sarcasm and satire has a unbelievably incisive way of, I say that well-timed satire is akin to the surgeon's scalpel cutting through warm butter, through the bullshit of, right? Because it's so, right? And that's why, by the way, dictators, the first people that they try to kill are, the smart people, the satirists, because they're not worried about the guys who have big muscles. They're worried about the guys who have the big brains and the big mouth, the sharp tongue. And so I completely agree with you that satire is an incredibly powerful way, not only to deal with realities for yourself, but in trying to convince other, I use satire to show how ridiculous some of these idea pathogens are.
Yes, a good joke can really put it in perspective more than a long-winded reasoning could. So it's a tool that PC culture really wants to strip from you. Just no. If you think of a mind that's going through autism or ADD, then it's a mind of chaos in a sense. And so PC culture has no tolerance for chaos, not even constructive chaos. It just wants cleanliness and order. And I feel like cleanliness is an obsession with every authoritarian ideology.
Oh, I love that you said cleanliness. So let me mention another little part in the parasitic mind that speaks to cleanliness. So there is a hypothesis in evolutionary theory, well, and in medicine, called the hygiene hypothesis, which basically argues that the immune system, the human immune system, in order to function optimally, it has to be exposed to pollutants and allergens. So, for example, when you take kids who grow up on farms or who have pets that don't live in a perfectly sterile and clean world, they actually are much more likely to suffer from respiratory ailments like asthma. And the idea is that from a very young age, their system, their immune system, has been activated to respond to these pollutants. It's expecting that to work optimally. Well, there's a neuropsychiatrist that I cite in the book that takes this idea and applies it to the sterile echo chambers, right? When we are building echo chambers, ideological echo chambers, what are we doing? We're saying anybody who disagrees with me is an ideological pollutant. I don't want to be exposed to his ideas. I want my world to be only similar people. Well, then I argue in the parasitic mind, in the same way that the immune system needs the allergens to work well, our critical thinking needs opposing ideas to be triggered properly, to be activated. For me to be a good thinking person, just like you said about Bosnians, they go back and forth. In the Talmud, Jews, you sit one-on-one, the students, and they're constantly arguing with each other because they're hitting each other with different ideas so that they could hone their skills. Now imagine that in the universities, we're creating exactly the opposite of that. You either all agree that Donald Trump is Hitler, or else I will give you a bad grade, or else you won't be welcome in my lab. I've had people write to me who say, I mean, literally, and some of these letters, I put them in the book anonymously. Professor Saad, I just found out that my lab director has removed my name from a paper that I've been working on with him for 3 years because I said something complimentary about Donald Trump. I mean, is that really happening in American universities and Canadian universities, where if you say something positive about a politician that your lab director doesn't like, he removes your name from the authorship list? It's unbelievable.
I've heard so many similar stories from Swedish students that write me because they don't know who else to talk to about this stuff, about teachers that will give them bad grades if they express conservative viewpoints or similar things like that. It really is an education system that kind of educates people on how to be bigots and tyrants rather than thinking individuals.
Exactly. But and what's more nasty about that reality is that it is cloaked though in the rope of social justice. See, at least when Hitler came about, he wasn't saying that he's a sweet guy. So I know when the SS troops are coming, they're a nasty bunch. Whereas the today's progressives and social justice warriors are not saying we're nasty. They're saying we hold the moral high ground. We have the social justice. We are the progressives while being fully fascist. That is what really pisses me off and makes me, just like you, a super angry guy.
An angry foreigner, one might say.
An angry foreigner, one might say.
So it's been great talking to you. Where can people order your book?
Thank you. So, of course, it's all over on Amazon. It'll be out in exactly a week, October 6th. You can buy it from Regnery, who's the publisher. It's on, a million different portals. There's even an option to buy a signed copy option through premiercollectibles.com. So you can get a book that is autographed by yours truly. So hopefully you'll pre-order your copy and you will vaccinate yourself against bad ideas.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Cheers. Nice talking to you.